This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind chamber where, in the space of 28 minutes, you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, following the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the retaliatory missile strikes on US air bases in Iraq, I am asking, who are the Revolutionary Guard and what role will they play in what happens next? ...2020 so far. A top Iranian military commander assassinated at the orders of a volatile American president. Millions on the street chanting death to America and demanding revenge. People worldwide with that, are we on the brink of war feeling? If not tomorrow, then maybe next week? In the briefing room today, I'll be finding out what the actors in this drama really want and where this crisis could lead. But I think we need to start by understanding more about the unique organisation that the late General Qasem Soleimani belonged to, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, or IRGC. From Washington, I was joined in the briefing room by Ali Alfaneh, author of Iran Unveiled and senior fellow at the Arab Gulf States Institute. Ali Alfaneh, can you tell me, when was the IRGC formed?
It emerged from the revolutionary chaos of 1979. The Iranian military declared its neutrality in the course of the revolution. The United States government and the Carter administration also urged the military not to intervene in the process of the revolution. In those days, there were some young people who attacked the police stations and the garrisons of the army, looted arms, armed themselves, and started organizing small revolutionary committees. Some of these individuals were just university students. Some of them were peasants, some of them opportunists. But there were also a group of professional revolutionaries. Now, the Persian name of the organization is quite interesting because if we translate it word by word, it is actually the Army of the Guardians of the Islamic Revolution. The name Iran is not even mentioned in the name of the organization. And in the logo of the organization, there is no map of Iran. There is a globe, which tells me that this group of people, they had an internationalist outlook. They believed that if you have Islamist revolution in one country, it could very easily be defeated. However, if Iran exports its revolution abroad to the neighboring countries, it would be much more difficult for the enemies of the revolution to defeat it. That was the idea.
Now, did it develop a political role in Iran?
The role of the Revolutionary Guards was to protect the ideological foundations and the ideological nature of the regime. And that necessarily dragged the Revolutionary Guards into politically intervening in the domestic political process. And the political masters of the Revolutionary Guards, in particular the late Grand Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, he systematically used the Revolutionary Guards to suppress his own political opponents inside of Iran. And that, of course, politicized the Revolutionary Guard.
How after that did the Revolutionary Guard develop? What areas did they get involved in?
From 1980 to 1988, this institution was busy fighting the war against Iraq. It was trench warfare. Perhaps more than 250,000 Iranians were killed in the war. All the time, Grand Ayatollah Khomeini and other political leaders were telling the Revolutionary Guards officers, telling them that God was on Iran's side and Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq would be defeated. Well, it was not defeated. And towards the end of the war, you have 500,000 Revolutionary Guard members who are marching back to their villages and to their small cities armed, and they are going back to unemployment. So the leaders of the time managed to make a deal with the leadership of the Revolutionary Guard not to intervene in the politics of Iran, not to blame the clerical leadership for defeats in war, but engage in post-war reconstruction of the country. And more or less also gave the monopoly over post-war reconstruction to the engineering corps of the Revolutionary Guards. In other words, every single person who had been active in trench warfare against Iran for the past 8 years would be getting a job building dams, building electrical plants, building highways, roads, and hospitals. Now, the most important thing is that the Revolutionary Guard, apart from its military budget, was allowed to take money from the government for the work it was doing in Iran's post-war reconstruction and accumulate that extra money in its own banks and financial institutions.
Its own banks?
Yes, the Revolutionary Guard began establishing banks and financial institutions in late 1980s so that they had such great funds by the early 2000s that when the Iranian government began privatizing Iran's state-owned businesses and enterprises, one of the biggest bidders on Tehran Stock Exchange was actually the Revolutionary Guards. So,
sorry, I just want to get this straight. Are you saying that the Revolutionary Guard bought them?
That is correct. As an example, Iran Telecom was about to be privatized. Three companies were competing for ownership. Two of the companies were genuine private sector actors, and the third one was the investment arm of the Revolutionary Guard. The Revolutionary Guard managed to intimidate the private sector companies so they no longer were bidding for ownership, after which the Revolutionary Guard investors purchased the telephone company for $9 billion cash. That is the largest trade in the history of Tehran Stock Exchange. It's also important to know that at the time, the annual military budget of the Revolutionary Guard, the money that they received from parliament, was a meager $6 billion. So $9 billion in cash was the kind of money they had been accumulating through their business empire and its activities over the decades.
Does that mean that the Revolutionary Guard actually is a big employer?
Today, the Revolutionary Guard is the largest employer in Iran. So the finances of many Iranians depends on the Revolutionary Guard.
What other kind of operations do they run inside Iran?
The cultural field of life in Iran is heavily influenced by the Revolutionary Guard. Just as the United States has Hollywood, Iran has a huge institution called the Sacred Defense Cinema, which usually produces action movies about Iran-Iraq war, but also action movies about the war in Syria and other places. These action movies reach a very, very large audience. So the cumulative impact of all the roles that the Revolutionary Guard is playing in Iran is gradual transformation of the Islamic Republic from a theocracy ruled by the clerical elites to a military dictatorship led by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Ali Alfani on the Revolutionary Guards. But the Guards don't just operate inside Iran. General Soleimani was commander of their elite military unit, the Quds. So what are they all about? Also in Washington was Mirzad Burujerdi, director of the School of Public and International Affairs at Virginia Tech and co-author of the book Post-Revolutionary Iran.
The Quds Force was the special forces of the Revolutionary Guards. It was formed sometime in the 1980s during the course of the Iran-Iraq War. The idea for this unit was that, you know, in the course of the Iran-Iraq War, Iran had captured a lot of Iraqi soldiers, and they wanted to turn them against Saddam Hussein and therefore created a force made of these predominantly Iraqi Shiites. The Revolutionary Guards indoctrinated these folks and sent them back either for reconnaissance or to actually fight the Iraqi forces. And gradually the idea emerged that they needed to be a bit more organized. It's supposed to be the arm of the IRGC that gets engaged in overseas activities, helping Iran's allies, so let's say Hezbollah in Lebanon or the Iraqi Shiite, you know, militias, etc. So to coordinate activities with them and actually to train them.
Who controls them?
One would expect in terms of reporting lines that the commander of the Quds force will be reporting to the commander of IRGC. However, the commander really gets handpicked by the Iranian supreme leader, and therefore he reports directly to the supreme leader. What this means is that when an area, where a country, a theater of operation has been declared as truly significant to Iranian interest, then it is these guys and not necessarily the foreign ministry that is in charge of making important decisions.
Originally, it was set up in effect to kind of create and manage proxy forces abroad. How is that business managed?
They basically give any of the countries in which they are operating, so let's say Lebanon, if it was Bosnia, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Afghanistan, Gaza, right? They each get assigned to a Quds commander. And that person is in charge of the portfolio for that country. The rest of the infrastructure of the Quds force, as well as the IRGC, etc., provide all the type of supports that that commander requests. They get sent to countries in terms of special op operations. So we know, for example, that in the course of the Bosnian conflict, a lot of fighters were dispatched from Iran to go and fight along the Bosnian Muslims.
Is Quds seen internationally as a terrorist organization?
It depends on whom you ask. Last year, President Trump declared the entire IRGC as a terrorist organization, which was a first, as far as I know, to declare a major unit of another country's military as a terrorist organization. Therefore, once they did that, it was very easy to place somebody like Qasem Soleimani and label him as a terrorist. One can say that the fact that Quds Force has carried out assassinations and activities for non-state actors that have been engaging in terrorist activities, then there can be perhaps a case made legally.
Let's talk about Qasem Soleimani himself. Mm-hmm. How did he get to be head of Quds?
He joined the Revolutionary Guards and he proved his abilities in the battlefield. He emerged as a very bright and brilliant strategist and therefore went up the chain of command. And when the war ended in 1988, he went back to his city and was basically in charge of then dealing with stopping narcotics trafficking to Iran from places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. But then he was handpicked by the Iranian supreme leader in 1997. Soleimani spoke Arabic and was therefore able to be the point person for the Revolutionary Guards in terms of the theaters of operation that were important to them, i.e. Afghanistan, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Gaza, and lately Yemen, of course. Perhaps he's best known for turning the tide with Russian help in the Syrian conflict and then in Iraq.
Now, looking forward, what sort of role do you think Quds will play in deciding how to implement Iran's longer-term response to the assassination of Soleimani?
Whatever Iran decides to do, these guys will be in the forefront of it.
Merjad Bourajerdi. We'll come back to Iran in a few minutes to get expert assessment on whether various forces in that country want to take things now. But first, I want to know what the Trump administration's long-term strategy for dealing with Iran is and how it's been affected by recent events. And let's just recall that the US has imposed sanctions on Iran on and off ever since the revolution of 1979 and the embassy hostage crisis. These were relaxed in 2015 when the nuclear deal between Iran, the US, the EU, UK, Russia, France, China and Germany was signed. The deal aimed to ensure that Iran would not enrich uranium necessary for nuclear weapons production. President Trump pulled the US out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and imposed more stringent sanctions. To guide me and you through American thinking is Barbara Leaf, joining us from the US. She's the former ambassador to the UAE and now works as a senior fellow at the think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Barbara Leaf, what is US strategy towards the region and towards Iran in particular?
The administration continues to assert, as the president did yesterday, that it's a campaign of diplomatic outreach and an intent to drive Iran under economic pressure towards the negotiating table. I have to say, it doesn't look like that is working.
Is it therefore wrong to accuse the Trump administration of trying to bring the regime down, of seeking regime change through internal ruction?
Well, you have had anyone from Secretary of State Pompeo to the president himself say straight up, this is not about regime change. But what gets confusing is that at the same time you have officials say, as one did this past week, well, we're not driving towards regime change, but, you know, we may end up with regime collapse. I'm not sure really in the final analysis what the difference is if the collapse comes about because of economic pressures.
Well, I guess it's that if you argue for regime change, you think you know what the change should be. And if you get regime collapse, all you get is a collapse.
Well, yeah, I would say collapse, if anything, sounds more alarming. And you don't know what you get on the back end.
Are there circumstances, Barbara, in which you think that the most recent exchange won't be the end of the post-Soleimani affair?
Yes. So do military exchanges still exist out there as a possibility? Certainly. You've heard the Supreme Leader himself say that was not enough, that strike on U.S. forces in Iraq. And as time goes on and more people point out that it was almost a bit of political military theater more than an effort to do damage to U.S. forces or to kill U.S. troops, the pressure will mount again within the regime. They will plan to take other strikes. They will go back to their toolkit of asymmetrical options.
When we talk about asymmetric options, what are we talking about, Barbara?
Well, that ranges from cyber, of course, which the Iranians are developing quite a great capability. So mucking about with electrical grids, bringing down financial centers, et cetera.
Including in Europe, in Britain, or just in America?
Well, certainly you've seen concern here in the United States that that may be an option. But when I think about the asymmetrical tools, I think of the things that occurred over the summer. So you had these phantom attacks on shipping. You had attacks on energy infrastructure pipelines. And then you have proxies, of course, like the Houthi in Yemen, sending drones and missiles up towards Saudi Arabia. You have sleeper cells in any number of these countries. So there are a lot of ways that Tehran can turn up the heat on the Gulf countries. And what's the logic here? Well, to try to manufacture rifts, schisms in the relations between the U.S. and its Gulf partners.
But the last set of asymmetric actions of that sort went on with Washington taking out Soleimani. What would be the next step for a Trump administration that already thinks that this has been something of a victory?
So that's the very pertinent question. I do believe that neither Tehran nor Washington in any way wants a conventional war. But there's just a whole spectrum of options up and down the line, short of war. And that is where Iran plays really well, always has.
Barbara Leaf. So, back to Iran. What are the calculations of the authorities there? Will Iran seek further revenge? And if so, what form could it take? I'm joined now in the briefing room by Aniseh Basiri Tabrizi from the Royal United Services Institute, a think tank on international defence and security, and Azadeh Moaveni from the International Crisis Group. Azadeh Moaveni, what is the attitude towards the IRGC among ordinary Iranians?
I think there is certainly a range. Iran is a complex, in many instances, polarized society. The segment of the population that is very committed to the system that sees itself as devoted and loyal to Iran, this government, the Islamic Republic, sees the IRGC as a defender and protector of Iran. There are those who are more critical, who are disappointed with Iran's record of governance, who want more freedoms, and who have a much more skeptical, oppositional stance towards the Revolutionary Guard. I think it's worth saying, though, at moments like this, however, I think there is, and we've seen it in the scenes of the funeral, a sort of coming together, because there is a deep running current of Iranian nationalism. And I think a sympathy and resonance with the idea that Iran should have a significant regional role.
And if we were to kind of quantify the support that we've talked about for the IRGC versus opposition to them, what would you imagine we'd get?
The best way to do that is to look at the results in the looming parliamentary elections in February. And the main expectation is that the hardliners will have a bigger role in the parliament.
Azadeh, what would be your expectation for the February elections?
I would expect somewhat stagnant voter turnout to start with. I think there will be a segment of the population that just feels very despairing, very disappointed in the outcome of the last few elections that they've turned out to vote in. I think the West has really pulled the rug out from under the moderates. President Rouhani, who was reelected in 2017, promised engagement with the West would bring better living standards to Iranians, would bring Iran a more robust place in the world economy. None of that came to be through partly American sabotage of the nuclear deal and Europe's unwillingness or inability to preserve some of the gains Iran was promised under that deal. So I think there will be some apathy. There will be, I think, you know, reliable loyalist turnout that may then kind of push a hardliner victory. But I think given how the moderates have fared, largely through no fault of their own, it's hard to see them having a strong showing.
Now, let's look at what's driving Iranian policy towards America, Anise. How far has the IRGC itself been influential in shaping that policy?
The decision-making process is very complex in Iran. The Supreme National Security Council is the main body that shapes, really, the decision-making process, and the IRGC is one of the entities which is part of that body. That said, obviously, in different files, there is domination of one entity versus the other, so the regional policy. I think we could really say that the IRGC is the main body.
You mean policy towards other countries in the region?
Yes. I think the IRGC is really the main body that implements this policy. Again, that does not mean that there is no buy-in by others.
But it's complicated. I suppose I'm trying to imagine a meeting at which these people sit down and you have the foreign ministry and you have the IRGC and you have whoever else you have. And I'm just wondering, if there's a kind of disagreement about strategy, who wins out in that process?
Normally, the attempt is to take the decision at a consensus level. This is the preferred option. Obviously, that is not always possible. But we have seen, I think, over the past year especially, an unprecedented level of unity, a heavy buy-in by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and other entities which would normally disagree with some of the decisions.
Okay, so we're talking about a situation whereby there needn't be just total conflict and total difference in objectives. We might even have a degree of unity. So my next question is, what are their objectives with regard to foreign policy towards America? What do they want to see happen, Azadeh?
I think the system came together to sign the nuclear deal. And that was significant. I think the level of politicking and dissent and internal disagreement really markedly was resolved at that moment. And I think there was consensus that it was in Iran's best interest, that there was popular pressure, that there was economic pressure that required some sort of accommodation with the United States and the rest of the West. I think that remains largely, in the long term, the consensus aim of the system, whether we're talking about the IRGC, the foreign ministry, the supreme leader.
Now, honestly, there seems to be a contradiction here, which we've touched on in other programs, which is there seems to be, from the perception of the West, if you like, an almost an aggressive Iranian regional policy, the Shia corridor, the support for Hezbollah. Is it seen in Iran that there might be a contradiction between its regional policy and the desires which Azadeh's just talked about to come in from the cold?
Well, you can see it as a contradiction. I see it as different tactical approaches that are intended to achieve the same strategic goals. Normally, you would have the moderates and the reformists using a tactical approach which is more forward-looking in terms of engagement with the West. And you would have hardliners instead looking at more at the resistance kind of line to achieve the same exact goals. It's true that Iran continued to maintain a presence in the region after the nuclear deal was signed. It's true that Iran continued to support proxies in the region and to maintain its non-conventional capabilities between 2016 and 2017. But really, what we have seen in terms of aggressive behavior from the Iranian side started mainly from May 2019, which is when Iran decided to scale back its compliance from the nuclear deal, to conduct activities such as attacks to the tankers and Saudi Arabia and all of that. And the reason why that was decided was to defend itself and respond to a maximum pressure campaign to which Iran perceived there was no other alternative and to which engagement was not perceived as to be the correct answer.
So what strategically do they do now?
Well, we have seen the first reaction, which has been the attacks, the missile attack in Iraq. Some saying that this was the ultimate revenge to the killing of Soleimani, and some others, including the Supreme Leader, saying that this was just the beginning. I think a lot will be determined by the speech that was made yesterday by President Trump and how some sort of de-escalation can be reached, if at all. Because, yes, it might have been perceived as an olive branch to de-escalate, but in the end, the situation remains the same. We still have the maximum pressure campaign in place. We still have zero channels of communication between the US and Iran. And therefore, it's difficult to anticipate how effectively a de-escalation could be imagined.
Okay, well, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment here. In fact, not just kind of devil's advocate, but a perception of, let's say, an ordinary person in Britain or America, which is this bad guy is taken out. It's a big, big, big step. And there's huge kerfuffle on the Iranian streets and millions of people saying death to America, as millions of people often seem to do. Revenge, 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 revenge. Somebody lobs a couple of rockets somewhere and then they say, well, that's it. That's over now. We've had our revenge and so on. And the temptation will be to say, well, the Trump thing worked, taught you a lesson, you won't be doing that again in a hurry. Next time it happens, you know, we'll take another person out.
I think with the very real possibility that the US will have to entirely or significantly pull its troops out of Iraq, that it will potentially have to pull its remaining troops out of Syria, that it will no longer be able to play the role that it has been playing in the anti-ISIS coalition, battling an ISIS resurgence. That seems like a very imminent and real strategic win for Iran without it having to even do anything further at this stage. Because the way this assassination was carried out will realign things for the United States in Iraq in a way that has been a long-term Iranian strategic goal.
Isn't that exactly what Soleimani would have wanted?
Well, precisely.
I mean, are you saying that by killing him, the Americans may very well have got in the situation that was his objective?
Well, exactly. Which is why, from an American national, strategic, long-term perspective, it was incredibly stupid. And the Americans, because they will not experience an ISIS resurgence on their doorstep, I think, can afford, or the Republican Party under President Trump can afford to be so reckless in a way that the Europeans simply cannot. If ISIS is able to regroup and take advantage of this pause and plan external attacks as it has sought to do primarily in Europe, that will impact European security in a far more direct way, which is why I think it's so essential at this moment, which is still very fragile, for the Europeans to pressure the United States to have a constructive dialogue with Iran. If there's any moment that the Europeans should be pushing the United States to stick its neck out, it's now.
Azadeh Moaveni there with Anissa Basiri Tabrizi. And my conclusion at the end of all that is that in the struggle between Iran and the United States, calculations of victory and defeat should never be made too quickly. So hold on to your hats. My thanks to Ali Alfani, Mirza Burjerdi, Barbara Leaf, Anissa Basiri Tabrizi and Azadeh Moaveni. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Jordan Dunbar and Rosamund Jones. The editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including ones on the anti-vaccination movement, meat-eating and the environment, and what getting Brexit done actually means. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.